Hi, it's Linda Holmes. Take part in NPR's continuing efforts to bring you news and stories that matter. Visit nprlistens.org to share your feedback and opinions at nprlistens.org. You can have a say in the future of public radio. nprlistens.org. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we look back at the Super Bowl and ahead to the Winter Olympics and consider the place in popular culture of the huge sporting event and the attendant rah-rah-rah. Rooting interests, stories of heartbreak and triumph, and other things you can learn about while screaming at the television. Then we'll turn to a listener suggestion and talk about the poisoning of the well. What happens when a review you've read or the opinion of someone you trust makes something you like seem less likable? With our independence, anyway. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies, theater, pop culture, that kind of thing.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm happy to see everybody back together around the table again. We thank our pal Gene Demby last week, and I'm sure that Trey, in particular, would thank our pal Gene Demby for the fact that Trey did not have to watch the 3-hour and 45-minute Grammy Awards.
I have expressed my gratitude to him more than once.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, we are here to celebrate Glenn's favorite event of the year. Yeah, that was actually the little thing that you heard was not a tire deflating. It was Glenn going. So we did want, as we taped this on Monday, the Super Bowl was last night. It was a blowout. For those of you who perhaps didn't hear about it, who are still wanting to talk about it with your pals, the Seattle Seahawks destroyed the Denver Broncos, beginning, it must be said, if you missed it, with a wonderful play in which the ball was snapped over Peyton Manning's head, which really rarely happens. I mean, that is rare in football.
Right. That's entry-level professionalism, right?
It was also, like, I could do that.
I could do that. Snapping the ball is tricky. It also happened in the first, 15 seconds.
Yeah, it sure did. It sure did. It was a pretty big blowout Super Bowl. I was happily, as I have been for 10 Super Bowls in a row, I was happily ensconced at Stephen Thompson's house at his chicken eating contest. With the Super Bowl just in the rearview mirror and the Olympics, they'll sort of be underway.
Well, the stomping around with flags will be underway.
The stomping around with flags will be underway. We wanted to talk a little bit about the place in popular culture of sports. Now, I feel like we can only start this. I hope he will forgive me. I hope Glenn will forgive me if I share with you Glenn's description of this topic as he summarized it for us when saying, so do I correctly understand the topic? Here it is. Got to consult my notes.
Dramatic reading.
Glenn said, the Super Bowl / Winter Olympics, two massive sporting events that are boring and obnoxious and that dominate American life without even having the decency to feature hot male gymnasts or divers in Speedos, no, just a lot of bulky clothes and puff pieces about the human spirit being triumphant and whatnot.
That was actually so long that your disdain toward Glenn kind of fizzled out halfway. Yep. At first, you're kind of the Super Bowl and the obnoxious, and then eventually you were just like, and also some more words.
Okay, I'm gonna start just briefly with Glenn. What is the nature of this response from you that is so powerful? You are normally such a live and let live
sure.
kind of guy. What creates this feeling in you that the existence of sports on your television oppresses you?
No. It's just, this time of year used to be pretty good because football was over. But now I don't even get that because now as soon as football is over, the Olympics start up. The Olympics, with their proprietary blend of jingoism and sentimentality and polar fleece, that's what you got right there.
Mm-hmm.
Not watching the Super Bowl, not watching football, is a life choice. It's like the last day of gym class, that day when you realize you will never have to go to another gym class again. Because my parents are such fervent football fans, football was just sort of ingrained in me. And
at the same time, they never had to watch the Eagles in the Super Bowl.
That's certainly true, but that became a source of
Sick
much...
burn that Glenn doesn't care about.
Don't care remotely about.
It was a burn on your parents. It was exactly. Like, suck it, Glenn's parents.
Exactly. It's just... It's
so this is rooted in Shouty Day.
It's rooted in chatty day. It's rooted in the fact that sports are a brine that this country has been pickling in for over 100 years. It's inescapable. Now, you know, I could just turn it off, and in fact, I do, except when we're going to sit and make it the A topic of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Well, here's the thing, Glenn. You say you have nothing to say.
Right.
And then I just poke you.
Yeah.
And you just, it's like winding up the little, you know those little chattering teeth on feet?
Mm-hmm.
That you wind them up and they just go chatter, chatter, chatter. And they walk around. They're so entertaining.
It's like squeezing a bile duct.
Yeah. It is like
squeezing. So if you have fervent thoughts about a pop culture related topic, it behooves us.
It's like gym class. It's like the last day of gym class. It's like the last, when WXPN came around in Philadelphia and I realized I'll never have to listen to classic rock again because I can listen to this channel. It's like the day, which we've talked about before, when I don't have to read Fred Bassett ever again.
All right.
Ever again.
So I'm going to swing around.
Okay.
I've been facing Glenn. Visualize it in your minds. I'm going to swing around to face Stephen Thompson.
Our nation's love affair with sports began.
Yep. Yep.
When dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Yep, yep, yep.
Ever since cavemen swung large sticks at other cavemen.
Stephen.
We've had a love affair with sports.
Now, Stephen, the entire time that I've known you, despite the fact that I enjoy sports.
You could start so many sentences this way.
I enjoy watching sports.
Sure.
I have certainly.
You are not a non-sports fan yourself. Let's not pretend for a moment. You are in many ways a more well-rounded sports fan than I am.
But this is entirely my point, is that despite the fact that I am a sports fan, I have still had to pretend to be a little more of a sports fan sometimes to keep up with Stephen, who very early in our friendship, you know, was sending me detailed emails about the Vikings and the Packers, which I, to some degree, was sort of like, oh, yeah, totally. So, Stephen, as I swing around to you.
Sure.
Sports and you go back a long way, yeah?
Well, they go back a long way, but I mean, Glenn made the point about gym class. I am no one's definition of a jock. Mm-hmm. I did not play high school sports. I only started ever playing any kind of sports when I became coach and captain of Team Onion Softball, the Onion's incredibly legendarily beleaguered softball franchise.
True.
I could cite all sorts of statistics to demonstrate our haplessness. And so I only kind of discovered any kind of enjoyment of playing sports in my late 20s. I never, ever, ever played as a kid. My parents held deep, deep Glenn Weldonian disdain. This is why I say that Glenn is the son my mother never had.
Yeah.
So I didn't really get into sports until even after college. But, you know, I've come to specifically really enjoy football, just watching football. I've never played football in my life. You know, I was struck watching the Super Bowl yesterday and having part of it is I'm hosting a party with like 50 people. So, you know, I'm running around, I'm only catching bits and pieces of the game, unfortunately. But I had the same reaction to the Super Bowl, getting specifically to this particular Super Bowl, that a lot of people did, which is that it was terrible. It harkened back to the Super Bowls of my youth when I didn't watch them, mm-hmm. and they had scores like 56-10 and 52-20. I mean,
we've been having some better ones.
We've had a string of very, very good Super Bowls, and this was just a back porch ass whomping, the likes of which we haven't seen in a Super Bowl in a long time. And it brought to mind a topic we've talked about long ago on the show about the price of pop culture and how there are certain pieces of pop culture that cost a few dollars. There are certain pieces of pop culture that are free provided you watch advertising. There are pieces of pop culture that provided you buy a gigantic box set, blah, blah, blah. Theater tickets, very expensive. Sports tickets, buying tickets to an NFL game are staggeringly expensive.
They are.
It's interesting. There is a topic. This is a topic in sports, Glenn, but bear with me, where there were several teams, including my beloved Green Bay Packers, that had a difficult time selling out their playoff games, which just seemed like absolute sacrilege. How your team is in the playoffs. You sell out during the season. How are you not selling out during the playoffs? Tickets were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And to make the comparison between a football ticket and a theater ticket, you don't go to the theater, have the lead twist his or her ankle, and say, we're going to put in somebody you've never heard of and watch us flail around for 3 hours. Sorry about the $1,000.
It can happen, but it's very rare.
I mean, it does happen, but it's much, much less likely to happen on stage. Yeah.
It doesn't usually turn into the complete clown show.
The game doesn't fall apart.
Right. It doesn't turn into a complete clown show with no warning and no refund.
Mm-hmm.
The way that sports do.
I mean, imagine some of the people who paid to watch the Broncos in that game.
Who paid thousands of dollars to fly not only from Denver, but from all over the place where sports fans live to go to New York and deal with all of the things that going to New York for a Super Bowl entailed. Yes. And so it's interesting. It brings to mind a larger idea about sports, which is that the blessing and the curse of sports, unlike so many forms of entertainment, is that they are in many ways, at least more so than most forms of entertainment, completely unpredictable.
Yeah. What you were talking about, about the cost of this particular kind of entertainment, is the only way that I connect to the NFL, I have to say. It is the cost of doing business with Washington's professional football team. Mm-hmm. And the way that particular team treats its fans and squeezes money out of them that fuels my utter loathing for that franchise. Mm-hmm. And so even though I couldn't name four of the players, I can name the owner
of
the team.
Or two.
Right? I can name the owner of the team.
You've probably seen enough Subway commercials.
Right. Yeah. I do, in fact, have a visceral response every time I see people talking about them on Facebook or Twitter.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, the reason why every time I think, maybe I'm not going to watch the Olympics, maybe I don't care about the Olympics, I always watch the Olympics. And it's because, you know, in this short period of like 2 weeks, you get to meet, come to care about, see the end of, and forget all about
have
people.
Have passionate opinions
about. I went back today.
Remember those Canadian skaters who should have won the gold and everybody was livid for like 3 days?
I went back today and I read a piece that I wrote about the 2010 Winter Olympics about the curling skip of the U.S. curling team, who I had quite strong feelings about, it turns out. It turns out I had quite strong feelings about what was happening to poor John Schuster, a name I could not have come up with at all, probably 3 days after I wrote that piece.
Right.
And I, one of the things I like about the Olympics is it suddenly will hurl you into these worlds that you know nothing about, whether it's, I mean, the big one in the U.S. for the Winter Olympics the last couple times around has been curling.
Right.
It hurls you into this universe you know nothing about. You suddenly become knowledgeable about it. You then forget it forever until 4 years later, it comes back and you start to look at curling and you go, oh, I remember this.
You remember
that
curling.
Raises, you do it this way.
But that raises, that means on late night television, there are going to be the same jokes that we had 4 years ago about curling, about luge, about the Jamaican bobsled
team. But hacks will be hacks will be hacks.
Yeah, but I mean, it becomes this lingua franca for a very brief time, and it's not. The thing
but
is,
you're
it's not.
But you're borrowing it. I mean, in a way, I mean, to compare the Olympics to another pop culture enterprise, like, for example, soap operas. I have not watched The Young and the Restless in years and years and years, but I bet if I do, Eric Braeden will still be there.
Like, this happened to me the other day when I accidentally saw part of General Hospital, and I just thought, not these people again. I mean, it was the people of my youth. It was the people of literally 30 years ago. We're still there, still the same people having affairs with each other. I saw two people, I saw two couples making out, and they've both been making out since I was no older than a teenager, and the Olympics are exactly
and
the same.
And it is
way.
The same. So, like, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, it's Oksana Bayul. And Oksana Bayul has been off being Oksana Bayul for 4 years, and then you come back and like, ah, here's the latest on Oksana Bayul. You know, look, it's gymnast Li Xiaoshuang. I actually remember these names. I don't know how. Yeah. I did not prepare.
Today I became like all, you know, exercise, thinking like, I wonder if I get to see the curling skip again. I wonder if it's the same guy. I have no idea. You know, I will come in and I will find out. And all of a sudden you come in, you meet some new 19-year-old with some adoring parents who are watching in the stands with their little hands balled up in fists because they're so excited. And everybody the next day is like, oh, did you see that guy's mom? He was so cute. He was so cute and his mom was so cute. And she was so excited because she was watching him on the Olympics. And you could just tell that it was the most exciting thing that ever happened to her. And she was the cutest thing. And he was the cutest thing, and I absolutely loved it. And people have these conversations.
It's true.
All
it's true. There's,
the
I mean, there's been so much social media buzz about this young figure skater who made the team, the guy with the ponytail. I can't remember his name now, but he's
I believe it's Ponytail McGee.
Ponytail McGee. He's got that thing. He's got that charisma and that zest for performing in front of a crowd that you just can't engineer. right? Yeah.
Trey is happy to talk about any sport into which we can incorporate the word zest.
Zest. It's the least surprising thing you've ever said, Trey Graham.
Yeah, but I mean, this is what I love about the Olympics, is you get all these little, like, tiny, tiny stories that you then forget all about until they roar back.
Well, and if it's any consolation to Glenn, one thing that Linda, I think, is touching on here is that the Olympics are a contained investment.
Yes.
They are, what, 16 days? It's basically like 2 weeks.
It's a compressed story arc.
It's a compressed story arc. They're not playing out over the course of months and months. They're only once every 4 years.
They're once every 2 years now.
I understand winter and summer.
I used to have to kind of portion my apathy out and get it all out in 1 year, but now it comes back and back and back every two.
Well,
go on.
If it's any consolation, the Winter Olympics are rather smaller than the Summer Olympics.
There are
41 categories of events. Categories, not events.
Right.
Within each category, there is like the 400 meter and the 1,000 meter.
Right.
All of this. That's in summer. In the winter, there are only 15 categories, and
TV are figure skating.
Right. And not to rag on Linda, but one of those is curling. Right?
Oh, yes, of course. Absolutely.
And then there's also skeleton, which is the one-man, you know, little teeny tiny sled thing. And and skeleton.
By Trey Graham.
Right? Skeleton, luge, and bobsledding. So of those 15 categories, three of them are basically about competitive gravity exploiting, and I would like to know why that qualifies as a sport.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are total analogs. I mean, they're total. You can make very easy comparisons between the Winter Olympics and the Summer Olympics. Mm. You have your gymnastics, and you have your ice skating, you know, form-based sports.
Ice skating form-based sports.
I had a little bit. There was a bit of a flourish.
There was a flourish in the right hand.
You've got your speed as measured by thousandths of seconds. Yes. Mm-hmm. You have your. I mean, they're skating and running.
I was going to say, Glenn's complaint about puffy clothing does not apply to the speed skaters.
Oh, no.
Or their thighs.
I'm talking about skinnier. I'm talking about, like, hot. I'm talking about hot, muscly gymnasts doing the Iron Cross. You don't get
That's all you want. Speaking of Li Shaoshuang.
In the Winter Olympics.
You know, it can't all be about that, though, Glenn. I mean, quite honestly.
Can some of it
be? No, because it's...
An iota of it
be? The one thing that the Summer and the Winter Olympics have in common is this notion of Olympism, which is where it breaks down for me. The notion that this gigantic, multinational, corporate-driven thing that comes
is
along
somehow
every 4 years
above
ago is
and
somehow...
The triumph of the human spirit.
Yes.
Right. Here's where I would defend the Olympics a little bit against the element that many people don't like that Glenn mentioned, which is the kind of jingoism element. For me, if I root for, you know, Team USA people, it's essentially for the same reason that if I am in a state and that state's football team is in the Super Bowl, I sort of find myself rooting along. It's not the superiority of the place where you are. It is simply your residence there. I mean, you're not really saying, I mean, I think if you're an American and you root for Team USA, it's for the same reason that a French person roots for French athletes. And I certainly expect everyone to do that. I don't, I'm not trying
yeah,
to.
I rooted for the Seahawks because they had more former Wisconsin Badgers on
it. Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to, I think the way to do that in a way that doesn't feel gross is to sort of say, like, rah for us and rah for you rooting for your team. Mm-hmm. And then everybody will go up and it'll be like, you know, it's school field day, mm-hmm. you know, if on field day,
just had a flashback,
but if on field day, you didn't actually have to go run, but you could just take the people from your homeroom or your classroom and say,
have them run for you.
We pick you guys because you guys are the fastest. We're going to sit over here, have a lemonade, and we're going to cheer real loud. Then that would have made field day much better for many people.
Yes.
And that's exactly, Olympics are just field day, where I just feel like these are the people you send out to be your team. Everybody else sends out other people to be their team. It doesn't have quite the loaded sort of like, we're awesome because we're awesome. It's just, we're just us because this is the country I live in.
The music comedy group Garfunkel & Oates have a song called Sports Go Sports. And what they're calling, what you're referring to, is that you feel temporarily adjacently victorious.
Watching able-bodied millionaires play with each other, watching less agile millionaires talk about it on TV. May they compile copious points so they are rewarded and meritorious, so you feel temporarily adjacently victorious. Sports go sports! Athletics are number one! Participants are heroes! Go team, yeah!
You're missing out on being temporarily adjacently victorious.
You don't have to do any of the work yourself.
Of course, that's right. The other thing is, of course, and we should say, the other great part is that the opening ceremonies are the Oscars of sports.
Right.
In that you get to watch all the teams walk out, And fortunately, this year, I won't feel bad about making fun of anyone's outfit because we have the worst.
We have the worst. Right.
So I won't feel bad about, you know, sort of saying like, well, that's an interesting looking ensemble you've chosen there.
Estonia.
Because ours is the worst. We have already decided to go. If you
Which
see
I think
our
is a, that's
outfits,
doing the world a solid. I
it
think
is.
That's
a good, it's but doing I, the world. You go out there, you wear something that is not cool.
Well, and I don't know that I would liken the Olympic opening ceremonies to the Oscars, because in the Oscars, occasionally something happens.
Well, yeah.
Seriously, like every yeah. 2 years, or whenever there's a new Olympics, I'm always like, all right, I'm going to watch the Olympics for 2 weeks. I'm going to do nothing. And then, like, the first night, I clear my incredibly busy child-having schedule. I'm like, it's on. I'm going to watch some Olympics. And then it's like, step, four hours. It's 4 hours of people walking.
No, yep. It's the, you got to watch for the great parts. The athletes are like filming each other with little cameras and people are, you know, they're getting all excited and recording their experience. And you can tell that it's like the most exciting thing that's ever happened to them.
Isn't that the same as like watching the Today Show and just having the screen be nothing but the window behind the people talking? That's basically what the opening ceremony. I turn into Glenn Weldon.
Well, you
No, Linda, you kind of were starting to touch on this point before, and I want to get back to it about the Olympics and sports in general that makes a casual sports fan a more intense sports fan, and that can make the Olympics a more intense feeling for casual sports fans, which is the idea of intermittent reinforcement, where like every once in a while something legitimately awesomely great will happen, or legitimately awesomely strange, or legitimately awesomely like that you really will like register as a moment of being fabulously entertained that you don't necessarily get from most scripted entertainment. And so like the Winter Olympics 4 years ago, I have this wonderful parental memory of letting my son stay up super late and having him kind of like rush downstairs when Shaun White, the snowboarder, suddenly did his thing. And there's this amazing moment a historic snowboarding run. How do you like that combination of words, Glenn? Yeah. Where suddenly Shaun White elevated like in this completely impossible superheroic way and then did some stunt that no one had ever done when he didn't have to in order to win. It was just this absolutely bonzo moment of athletic greatness that was just ridiculously fun to watch and ridiculously fun to share with my kid. Sports has that element of you watch in the hopes that something wildly fun and amazing is going to happen, but you also run the risk of it being just a spectacular, which the Super Bowl was yesterday, not counting, of course, the Bruno Mars halftime show.
It's true. Yeah, sports are unpredictable, and that's why we love them. Glenn Weldon.
Accepted. Sports. Glenn Weldon accepted.
Sports grump. Sports grump among us.
I want to know, does it work better for you in a virtual realm? For instance, on your game console?
Oh, I can't imagine playing a sports video game. That would be the most boring thing. It would be like once removed from boring.
So you haven't fallen into the trap of breaking Madden this season?
Oh, God, Madden. No.
When Glenn starts talking about this, he turns into like a, I don't know, some sort of like...
He's a Dickens character.
British. Yeah, he starts into some sort of horrified British actor.
The idea.
Oh, my.
The very idea. Oh,
no. It turns into like John Lovitz in that Saturday Night Live skit where he used to say, oh, my... all right. Well, I don't know how many of you all out there watch the Super Bowl or the Olympics, but, you know, we will for the next 2 weeks still be talking about the Super Bowl. No, just kidding. Just kidding, Glenn. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and talk to us a little bit about how sports watching intersects with your particular life. Before we move on to our other topic, we did want to touch on something that came up yesterday. As I said, we're taping on Monday, and yesterday we very, very sadly learned of the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, an actor who has been in a bunch of P.T. Anderson movies and is in Mission Impossible 3 and the Hunger Games movies. And it's just... When I wrote about him this morning, the thing that I said is that, you know, no matter what list of his work you come up with, you feel like you're not only leaving a bunch of stuff out, but leaving a bunch of people's favorite things out because everyone has different favorite things. I mean, The Master and Boogie Nights. And he also has, you know, small parts. If you go back and you watch like a movie like Twister, you all of a sudden see like, oh, that's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Right.
And so we did want to just acknowledge that real quick.
I was pleased with my Twitter feed yesterday and today, because instead of dumb jokes, like everybody has to get the first dumb, crass joke in, what people were doing were just putting clips of the time when they realized this guy was the guy.
Yeah.
For me, it was the scene in Magnolia where he plays a nurse to Jason Robards' character. And there's this scene, which is such a high-wire thing. He has to be the actor in a movie who makes a phone call and says,
I know this sounds silly. And I know that I might sound ridiculous, like this is the scene of the movie where the guy's trying to get a hold of the long-lost son, you know, but this is that scene. This is that scene. And I think they have those scenes in movies because they're true, you know, because they really happen. And you gotta believe me, this is really happening.
And that is such a challenge.
It's such a hard thing to do.
Such a hard thing to do, and he totally sold it. He was amazing.
Yeah.
My most vivid memories of him are not from the movies, but from the world of theater.
Right.
I saw him do Long Day's Journey and Tonight with Vanessa Redgrave, and he's playing a character who's an addict, and it was one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen.
For me, I mean, this is going to come as a surprise to absolutely no one, but his performance as Lester Bangs in Almost Famous.
Well, it was fun.
Because they make you feel cool. And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
I know. Even when I thought I was, I knew I wasn't.
Right, because we are uncool. Now, while women will always be a problem for guys like us, most of the great art in the world is about that very problem. Hey, good-looking people, they got no spine. Their art never lasts. And they get the girls. But we're smarter.
Yeah, I can really see that now.
Yeah, because great art is about guilt and longing and, you know, love disguised as sex and sex disguised as love. Hey, let's face it. Yeah, you got a big head start.
I'm glad you were home.
I'm always home. I'm uncool.
It's funny because, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman was such a cool guy. Like, he was such a cool actor. He was an actor that cool people love.
Right.
And yet this defining scene is just all about how, like, don't be cool.
Yeah. Hmm. That's the performance, too, that I embedded a clip from on the blog when I wrote about him. Because for me, when he plays his early scene where he's sort of explaining this whole, all this business about rock criticism and what's real rock and roll, it would be so easy for that to be so insufferable and for that guy to just kind of instantly become everything that people don't like about kind of old school music guys who want to kind of dump on everything new.
And one-up everybody.
And one-up everybody. And to bring the kind of nuance to that part, you really felt the way that guy cared about that kid, like was carrying around, and he's kind of, you can see him, there's a part where he's chewing, and you can see him kind of, you know, thinking in his head about how much he wants to say about all of his own grievances about rock and roll and how much of it to put on this kid. It's all in this 3 or 4 seconds of him chewing and looking off away from the kid. It's all there. You could tell that he's just sitting there thinking, like, well, you know, on the one hand, I'd love to just dump out my whole theory, but do I really want to? And maybe he should hear it, and maybe he shouldn't. And it's just a wonderful performance because it's so rich, and it didn't have to be. And, you know, there are lots and lots of performances. He was in Doubt. He's in The Master. There's no wrong place to jump into.
He won
that.
An Oscar for Capote.
Yeah, there's no wrong place to jump in. You know, we encourage you, I think, to, if you kind of just surf around and look at a bunch of remembrances of him. Dana Stevens wrote one that was very, very nice. There are many, and we encourage you to look at them partly because, as Glenn said, a lot of people just took a moment to sort of direct you to performances that they really love of his. So we did want to take a moment to acknowledge him, and you know, everybody misses the work that they will never get to see.
So sad.
But in better news, we are always happy when we can share an idea that came to us from one of you. And this week, one of you had suggested to us the topic of well poisoning, which is sort of the idea of, which I liked that way of putting it. And the example that was given was somebody who said, well, you know, I used to really like New Girl, and then I knew somebody who pointed out a bunch of things that they didn't like about it. And after that, I just couldn't quite see it the same way. It's sort of the idea that I think of myself as an independent person, but it kind of got in my head. And it was like a little, I think he said worm. It's like a little mm-hmm. thing that gets into your head. And then you feel like the thing is ruined for you. So we were going to talk a little bit about this idea of the well poisoner. Now, I wanted to direct this at Stephen because I think of Stephen as somebody who really
enjoys... Very susceptible to the opinions of others.
No. A sharer, right? Mm-hmm. A person who loves to share things with others. And I wondered whether you have the experience of having other people kind of influence you, because I don't really hear you talk about that very much.
Yeah, it's interesting because I actually struggled for a while to come up with a perfect example of something, in part because when I love something, I will strenuously avoid takedowns of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think everybody to varying degrees fears that he or she is susceptible to the opinions of others, that you're going to love something and then Glenn's going to talk about how he doesn't like sports and then I'm going to be like, I don't like sports as much.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
That'll always be the dream. Tick. My mother and father tried and tried. I do tend to avoid pummelings, like why you shouldn't like something. I did bring, however, what I think is a pretty awesome example.
Okay.
Because it manages to be a thing that is kind of sort of poisoning the well of something I love. And yet it is itself so great that I share it as a recommendation. Look at how positive I am.
Mm-hmm.
To provide a little bit of a setup, this is a song by a singer named Robbie Foulkes, who is a wonderful, very versatile kind of roots rock singer-songwriter. He can be a country singer or he can be a rock singer or a folk singer. And he has a song. It's called Fountains of Wayne Hotline. To set up the clip that we've pulled of this song, it's this incredible little meta Rube Goldberg device of a song where he's playing the song, narrating the story of writing the song, and calling a songwriting hotline in the middle of the song to set up where he should go next with the song. And the song is laying out the formula of every Fountains of Wayne song ever. Now, I love Fountains of Wayne. I love
it's
Fountains
so
of Wayne.
Good,
their first, the first three Fountains of Wayne albums are basically perfect. They're a little uneven after that. But this song lays out all of Fountains of Wayne's formulas in a way that make it hard to ever hear Fountains of Wayne songs ever again. The clip that I'm setting up is one of those interludes within the song where he is talking to one of the operators at the Fountains of Wayne hotline.
What you need to do now is employ the radical dynamic shift.
The radical... Yes, what do you mean by that?
You know, full band entry, fortissimo, while maintaining consistent apparent volume on the vocal track.
Oh. Yeah, that's a great idea. Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. We're always here.
Oh, it's so true. I love that so much.
It really
is. What a great choice.
It builds and builds. It's funny. But it builds and it builds the way a Fountains of Wayne song builds while commenting on the way Fountains of Wayne songs are written. And it's not a put down. It's not a takedown. It's actually, in interviews and everything Robbie Foulkes would say, it's very admiring.
Yeah.
He was struck by their incredible craft.
You can tell just from that brief clip that it's not a snide takedown, that there is a lot of scholarship that went into creating it.
Well,
right?
And at one point, he is just reciting all of the various chords in the song and like very, very specific music terminology,
yeah.
But that you can kind of figure out what it means even if you're not deeply into music.
And the other thing that's great about it is it's just so much fun to listen to. Like, I'm not going to remember it, but it's that part where he goes like,
slightly distorted melodic solo. Check!
It's just a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. That's a great pick. I don't have anything nearly as good as that. Trey Graham, are you susceptible to the opinions of others?
I had two worries about this segment. One was that because we generally do try to talk about things we like rather than things we don't like, I was worried that this was going to be a real downer of a segment.
Sure.
I also tend to be a bitter ender, as I've discussed.
You do.
Often.
True.
Desperate Housewives, Heroes, watched them all. And so I was kind of at a loss until last night at the Super Bowl, a thing presented itself to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I offer it up here for your consideration.
We watched the soccer
that is, of course, Renee Fleming singing the national anthem before the game, before the coin toss. And I used to really love her. I saw her live at Carnegie Hall at one of Marilyn Horne's birthday concert fundraisers back in the 90s, before she was terribly famous, and she was glorious. She sang a John Kander song called Letter from Sullivan Ballou. I was dazzled, and I remained dazzled for several years. In American opera in the 90s and maybe early 2000s, specifically in Carlisle Floyd's Susanna, where she has this magnificent aria called Ain't It a Pretty Night, she was such a clean, clear, classy singer. And then she started letting her sort of jazz inclinations inflect what she was doing with classical music. It was the writer James Jordan, who is an opera critic and blogger. He began to harp on how much that was changing the tenor of what she was doing. And I couldn't unhear it after that. And it helped. It didn't help that she kept kind of doubling down on the style, even in the face of criticism from people who aren't quite as much of a gadfly as James Jordan.
Right,
and he likes to, he likes to poke.
Sure.
What had begun as a mild overuse of portamento had become this swoopy, scoopy indulgence.
Right, sure.
Opera singers, especially lady opera singers, get nicknames all the time. Maria Callas was La Divina. Joan Sutherland was La Stupenda. And they've started calling her, sometime in the 2000s, La Scoopenda. Because she's always sort of scooping into these notes. And it just started sounding tacky to me. She's rangy. She doesn't just do her one thing. She's done the jazz stuff. She's done a kind of alt-pop album.
Oh,
and she's scheduled
alt-pop album is so bad. I mean, I really admire the ambition, but it's like, one soul meets body. So bad.
Oh, my God. It is almost never a good idea when an opera singer does pop. And she's going to do a straight play this summer at the Williamstown Festival. And, you know, I got to... Whatever, she doesn't need my approval. She's got all the money in the world.
And she's been ruined for you.
Yeah, but she's kind of been ruined for me.
Well, thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon.
When a comment from outside is objectively true, it may or may not land. The key is it has to resonate. You have to be vibrating on exactly the same frequency. You have to agree specifically that that's a good point. I mean, Anthony Lane is a brilliant critic, and I read his stuff all the time, and Anthony Lane from The New Yorker, and whenever he reviews anything about a superhero film, I know what he's going to say, so I can kind of say, okay, dude, you're not even engaging with this. So all of that, even though you make some good points, it doesn't matter. I thought about this because I played an episode of the show Billy on the Street, a show I like very much, on the Fuse Network, with Billy Eichner going around New York interviewing people, to a friend of mine, and she was really down on it. She said, boy, all he does is yell at people. And I was like, well, that's kind of the thing. I mean, it's kind of like saying, watching Jack Benny and going, why does he keep talking about money? You know, I mean, what's with those pauses? It's kind you have to commit to this thing. So to find an example that actually worked, I'm afraid I have to break the Zaxxon rule a little bit. But it will seem tangential, but it'll come around eventually. But when I graduated from college, I had a degree in marine science, and I knew I didn't want to be a scientist because science was too hard. And I wanted to be a writer, man. And I wanted to just be out there and writing things. And there is a... Within the writing sort of, especially the teaching writing community, there's this concept of creativity as an end-all be-all. Creativity is this abstract concept, creativity with a capital C, as a thing that you have to really nurture and be out there. Not craft, not skill, not technique, not actually doing the work, but just being creative. So I was doing a lot of free writing at this time. Free writing is where you write sentences without, you know, kowtowing to the rules of grammar and meaning and logic, because you're just expressing yourself, man. And
this this is how you end up at Bret Easton Ellis.
Exactly. Well, see, what I would do is I would scrawl, like, because passion, scrawl these sentences on pieces of paper, and I'd slap them up on my wall so they could kind of help me, you know, think differently, man. And I remember one of them was, red velvet hippos with perfect aplomb quaff the mahogany chafing dish. Right, man. You're like, Glenn, that is so wild and so expressive and unfettered. And I'm like, yeah. So I'd put them up over my desk and stare at them and be inspired, have my mind go in a different direction. And a friend of mine came over. A friend of mine, not a writer, an engineer, as a matter of fact. He came over and he looked at my desk and he's like, so what's this? And I gave him the spiel about expression. And he said, huh, is it, that doesn't seem a little contrived? And it was like, and I was a pile of ashes with two blinking eyes in it. And I was like, no, what? You're contrived. Shut up, no. But it was that word. If he had said pretentious, I would have dismissed. You're not a writer. You don't know. contrived was exactly it, because it was, what was that about? That was about the persona, the writerly persona, all the window dressing that goes with being a writer. Not actually writing, not actually doing any work, but just nurturing creativity for creativity's
sake.
So
you don't mind if I take that Red Velvet Hippos thing?
No, it's all yours, man. It's all yours. Maybe it'll take you as far as my fiction took me.
They're quaffing that chafing dish.
I want that sentence with bongos underneath to be our new theme song. No offense, Mike Katzef.
Yeah. No.
I agree. You know, as I thought about this topic, I thought if I were entirely impervious to the opinions of others, I think I would find these kinds of conversations about culture much less interesting.
Right.
So it's never my goal to be impervious to the opinions of others. So when I come in, like, for example, when we came in and we talked about, like, Man of Steel, for example, I liked that movie more than, certainly more than you did, certainly more than Steven did.
Oof.
But as I listened to you talk about it, I did sort of reconsider what I had thought. And I thought, yeah, you know, these are very fair criticisms.
And Steven in particular is very smart.
Insightful.
On the other hand, when I really believe something, I can be completely impervious to the fact that other people hate it. Please see recent conversations about Billy Joel. I am not moved by the quantity of disagreement. For example, I wrote today about not liking Seinfeld, which I am in the extreme minority about, especially among the people, the circles in which I run. So I can certainly be impervious to something like Seinfeld, where if I don't like it, I don't like. Sex and the City, same thing. Many writers I know love Sex and the City, same thing. Does nothing for me, leaves me cold. But I like the fact that I am sometimes affected by what people think. So I don't know if I have so much a single example other than to say, when we have conversations about things on this show, I very frequently, like, walk out of here thinking something slightly different than I did before. And it's the challenge for me with well poisoning versus like letting Steven give me something to listen to and just saying, like, this is awesome. And then trying to maintain some sense of my own independent thought. It is a really difficult balance, because you find yourself kind of going back and forth between you want to be soaking up lots of stuff from other people and what their interests are, what their perspectives are. But you also want to maintain kind of your own taste. And that's why when it happens every now and then that I respond totally differently to essentially anyone else in the world to something, I'm always really reassured by it, because it means I'm still thinking for myself. I am the only person I know, literally, I am the only person I know who defended that stupid, and I say stupid because it is stupid, but this stupid comedy that Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston were in, which everyone hated. But when I saw it, I thought, I normally hate comedies that Adam Sandler is in. I am not a big fan of him in these kind of comedies, but I found this kind of affable and I enjoyed it and I had a good time. If I were to kind of look from the outside at my own opinion, I'd be like, I'm probably wrong. But I still had it. That was what my opinion was. That was what my reaction was. And I thought, well, good. I'm not being influenced by what absolutely every other person that I know in the world on the planet thinks. So it's that balance.
Two things. What's the name of that film?
Just go with it.
Just go with it. Okay. B, something, the opposite of well poisoning has happened in this room to me many times, where I'm down on something and our conversation turns me around on it.
Does it turn you around in Man of Steel?
No. Frozen.
Frozen. Yeah.
Our discussion of Frozen, yeah. I still think Tangled is a funnier film. I still think Tangled's a better film. But your point, specifically your point about it being seen multiple times, so all that stuff at the beginning, which felt to me very rote, that's the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
I totally get that now. And it has changed my opinion of the film.
So that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, next week, for those of you who don't necessarily want to watch Wall-to-Wall Olympics, we will be launching at NPR Music. I don't believe it's been formally announced as of this taping, but it is on Twitter at NPRandB.
Okay.
NPR and B.
Mm-hmm.
The project is called I'll Take You There.
Nice.
Which is a great title, and it is hosted by a terrific writer named Jason King, and it is NPR Music's foray, a very involved foray into R&B music, and I've been hearing a lot about it. I'm preemptively extremely excited about it. It's going to be super cool. We're launching it early next week. I don't want to give an exact date lest they
fantastic. Thank you, Stephen. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Three quick things. The DC Snowy Owl, I don't think she has a name, is reportedly improved improving.
Oh, good.
Greatly.
This is the owl that was hit by a bus?
This is the owl that was hit by a Metro bus here in D.C. at McPherson Square. She'd been kind of living around the Washington Post building and McPherson Square and that area of town right in the middle of downtown Washington, D.C. Got hit by a bus, poor thing, and taken to the National Zoo where many animals go to die.
Because it actually turned out that there was one more thing that is terrible about our public transit system.
Right, right. But the snowy owl is apparently getting better and, of course, has a parody Twitter account.
Of course.
A stage musical of Back to the Future has been announced.
Oh, fantastic.
To open in London next year, 2015, for the 30th anniversary of the movie, the 30th anniversary year of the movie. And finally, today in my mailbox arrived a screener for the forthcoming documentary, Elaine Stritch, Shoot Me.
Oh, nice.
Which I have watched enough of already to know it's going to be a winner.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you, Trey. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
You know who gets Twitter? Here's a guy who gets Twitter. Colin Quinn gets Twitter. He tweets at I am Colin Quinn. It's an ongoing performance art piece of celebrity culture. He has a persona in his feed of a fatuous, self-impressed celebrity whose insights are gifts to the world. And there is this very condescending folksiness. A lot of the tweets end with, right, gang? And there's something about it. It's anti-comedy, right? He's going out of his way not to be funny. And for some reason, and I'm going to read you a couple, and you're not going to find them funny. When it occurs in your feed next to other vacuous things,
right,
it's you can feel his presence behind. You can feel the irony. But layover in Chicago, gang. Dub Bears. The Windy City is living up to its name, hoo boy. Burr gang. I don't know. There's just something about it. Getting ready to board the plane at LAX. Why do they call it the terminal? Woo, that's scary. Right, gang? And I guess bad weather is what gives us that crazy New Yorker attitude. Haha, like, hey, watch where you're going, Mac, etc. I don't know. It's probably just a me thing. But, man, try it. Just
it's
add
what you
it.
Watch instead of sports.
Add it to your Twitter feed. I think you're going to enjoy it as much as I do.
Wonderful.
I am Colin Quinn.
All right. It is extremely rare for me to talk in what is making me happy about anything that I am doing. But this week, we are launching a series on the blog of videos that I made with our dear friend Bob Mondello to prepare for the upcoming Oscars. What we did is, with the help of some very wonderful people from NPR's multimedia team, we found a bunch of internet comments about movies, and Bob and I gave dramatic readings of some of these comments about the Best Picture nominees. By the time you hear this, the first two parts, which are American Hustle and Her, should be up. And I encourage you to look at those. They will be on the blog at npr.org/monkeysee. It is the first thing like this that I have done. I am normally extremely self-conscious about anything like this. I do not normally do this kind of thing. And I also forgot they were filming it on the day that they filmed it. So I was not exactly prepared. I did not have my boa and so forth.
Your tiara.
Upon me. But
you weren't in your red carpet wear.
But we had a very lovely time. I love doing projects with Bob. I love doing projects with multimedia. It is something that I've never done before, and it makes me giggle. They're very silly.
They're just very charming. For one thing, even if you don't like Linda Holmes, I totally understand.
Yeah.
But Bob Mondello is awesome.
I agree. Even if you...
That guy's a sport.
Just for Bob Mondello, it's completely and totally worth it. So being able to do that cool project, which I'm excited about, makes me happy. And it's launching this week. And by the time you hear this, it will be on the blog. And we'll make sure that you have a chance to see it. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Steven. I dislike Steven, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And don't forget the underscore. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Hi, it's Linda Holmes. Take part in NPR's continuing efforts to bring you news and stories that matter. Visit nprlistens.org to share your feedback and opinions. At nprlistens.org, you can have a say in the future of public radio. nprlistens.org.